Hello, nerds!
I'm Richard Molina.
And I'm Angela Weber.
And you're listening to Nerd Portland Radio, the show where we talk about games, science fiction, fantasy, books, comics, and science, and all the other nerdy stuff you can do here in Portland.
This week on Nerd Portland Radio, we talk about space, we chat with comedian Joseph Scrimshaw about his love of British television shows with reincarnating male leads, and we take a field trip to see some extreme pub trivia.
Welcome to Nerd Portland Radio.
We start this week's show with a very special local event, Puzzled Pint. Can you explain to us what this is, Richard?
Absolutely. Puzzled Pint is a monthly event here in Portland where teams meet up to solve puzzles and drink beer.
So if you've been to a pub trivia kind of event, it seems similar.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it's good. It's close, but there's lots more like numbers and codes and craziness. It's also spreading across the country.
Across the world, in fact.
Oh, across the world. That's right. We're in London now. We stopped into the Green Dragon in southeast Portland to talk to the founders of Puzzled Pint.
When you walk into Puzzled Pint, you see 100 people staring intently at these strange pieces of paper and scratching their heads. Some resemble the sort of puzzles you might remember from those extra credit sheets in math class. Logic puzzles, or big sheets of numbers. But locked inside these puzzles is a secret code in a strange language, and each requires a lot of thinking. The whole process is strangely, even shockingly addictive, and you never know what the next puzzle will be.
Yeah, that the rebuses were all titles of different James Bond movies. Once you got that, you had to then determine which number, like which movie in the sequence it was. So like Dr. No would be number one, Skyfall would be 23, I think.
People were solving puzzles all night using different things on the wall at Kennedy School, different murals and such. And at the end, they realized that the answers they got out of all the puzzles said, disassemble writing utensil. And they took the pen we gave them at the start and broke it open, and inside was the final puzzle. And they'd been using that pen all night long. It was a great aha moment for all of those teams.
A bag with a bunch of square pieces of paper on it with lines and words on it, and there was one that was folded. And we had to fold all the other pieces the same shape. And it turns out that you can slide different flaps into other flaps based on words that are in them. And when it was done, it was this awesome, like, three-dimensional star.
Anna, Curtis, Matt, and Victor are part of the group that works every month to make Puzzled Pint happen here in Portland. The seven members of the eerily named Game Control found their start when Victor gained some inspiration during one of the earliest puzzle events in the Northwest.
Curtis and Deanne were running Dash 2 here in Portland, so I talked to them afterwards saying, hey, I have this idea for an event where people sell puzzles and leads them to a bar, and that was it. That was the entire extent of the event, because I wanted to learn how to make puzzles. And then, so Curtis and Deanne joined, Anna joined, and Matt joined, and we got together, and I was like, let's make it more like a trivia thing, where when you get to the bar, you get more puzzles as well.
Closing in on the end of its fourth year of operation, Puzzled Pint defies easy description, much like the puzzles they enjoy so much. However, Game Control used their vast expertise to give it a try.
Puzzled Pint is the only worldwide pub puzzle event.
People just get together second Tuesday of every month and hang out at the bar with their friends, drink some beer, eat some food, and solve puzzles.
While it may have started small, Puzzled Pint has grown well beyond its Portland roots. Puzzlers across the nation, and now even across an ocean, meet on the second Tuesday of each month to compete and solve and drink. I asked Victor if anything like this exists anywhere else in the world.
Not as far as we're aware of, not a monthly event. I mean, we've been going for over 3.5 years now, every single month. And as far as we know, there's nothing else like this. It's been awesome to see it grow. We had 17 people the first Puzzle Pint, and now we're in 5 cities, Portland, London, Seattle, Chicago, and Missoula, which is pretty awesome.
We spread to all these other cities by accident. It was never part of the plan. We had people in other cities who were interested in hosting the event, and we said, sure, we'd love for you to simulcast it, which is far beyond our wildest dreams of what Puzzle Pint would be. Like, our wildest dreams were still going on 4 years later, which is what we're doing today in Portland. So we were pretty excited by having other people do it around the world.
Puzzled Pint now fills almost every bar in Portland it can find. Even so, the siren call of the puzzle still attracts new players each month. Matt and Curtis have some words of advice for anyone who wants to join in.
They just need to be interested in puzzles to try out Puzzle Pint. Puzzle Pint's supposed to be an event for folks that maybe have never tried a puzzle before, but this sort of puzzle sounds interesting. And it's supposed to be a nice, low-key, low-barrier to entry event. It's at a bar. It's not very competitive. So it's just supposed to be a nice introduction to puzzles.
So we come up with lots of different types of original logic-type puzzles. Like, some of them involve wordplay, and some of them are based on things you might have seen before, like crosswords or Sudokus or other things. But they're kind of, they always have some sort of little twist in it, and there's a hidden message that you have to pull out of there.
At the end of a night of puzzling, expect your brain to be pleasantly exhausted. It's a unique kind of mental workout, and one that Puzzled Pint has expertly provided to the Portland community free of charge. That's right, free. Lucky for all of us, money just isn't the reason why they do it.
It's just, you know, it's a fun hobby. It's a way to exercise my brain, and it's really cool, like, building this community and meeting all these awesome people who love these things. It's been a blast. It's kind of, like, cool to be able to build something from the ground up. Like, we never thought this would be successful or as popular as it has been. So it's been very gratifying for it to happen like that.
Puzzled Pint happens at a different bar every month, and you have to solve a puzzle to find out where, nerdy. But it does happen next Tuesday, right?
That's right. Check puzzlepint.com on Monday to try your luck. There's plenty of hints, and the goal is to have fun instead of getting stumped. So ask for help if you need it.
Yeah, and look at Richard. He'll help you.
I will be there.
So how has your week been, Richard? What are you geeking out about these days? You did this earlier, and I told you to shut up until the show started. So what happened?
Right. They discovered a new exoplanet.
Okay, and for those of us who don't know, what is an exoplanet?
Okay. An exoplanet is a planet that revolves around a different star than ours.
Okay, that's so all. A different solar system.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And they found a new one?
Yeah, so we found about like 2,000 of them in this tiny little section of space. But this one is super important.
Okay, why?
Okay, so we thought it was just a really big like gas giant, but researchers have discovered that it's also really massive. So It could be strong enough to have an atmosphere. It's in the zone. It could have, you know, it could have Earth-like qualities.
Oh man!
Yeah,
that's pretty exciting.
So that's kind of the thing we look for. That's the hope, is to find more Earth-like planets. And they call this one the Godzilla of Earths.
The Godzilla of Earths.
Yes,
because it comes out of an irradiated ocean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And exoplanets. You're saying we, but aren't there amateur astronomers that work on finding these?
Yeah. So NASA's got the Kepler satellite pointed at the sector of space, and they send out data, and people around the world just study the data and kind of find out what's going on.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it's good.
Exoplanets, everybody.
Yeah. All right, and what about you? I know you went to L.A., so what kind of nerdy hijinks did you get up to?
Yeah, not the nerdiest city, but I did. Excellent transition, actually. I sat down with my friend Joseph Scrimshaw. We did a show together there, and Joseph is a comedian, a performer, a writer, and he is really one of the biggest nerds I know, which I didn't really realize until we went to his apartment to record his podcast, and it was like, oh dear, we need to talk. So I sat down with Joseph Scrimshaw and talked to him about what made him a geek. I am currently sitting in the living room of Joseph Scrimshaw. Hello, Joseph Scrimshaw. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Joseph, you are a comedian, you are a writer, you are on Twitter. How are there other ways you would describe yourself
no,
to the world?
I like squirrels.
Okay.
That's about, yeah.
And martinis.
I like martinis.
Yeah. And you are also a geek. Like, can you tell me how big of a part of your life that is?
Well, somebody on Twitter a while back called me geek flavored, mm-hmm. and I kind of ran with that because I think that there are humans and entertainers in particular who they decide how big of a part of their existence that is going to be, that like I make jokes about Star Wars and that's it.
Yeah.
And for me, I was a big geek growing up.
Yeah.
And it used to be that the geek world and the normal world were two different worlds.
Yeah.
And now that they are, in a lot of ways, the same world, I kind of feel like I like being part of both the normal world and the geek world.
Yeah.
And so
my band, the Double Clicks, and you have performed in the same venue several times, and it wasn't, like, you do jokes about things like Batman, and it's like, that guy knows more about Batman than I do. But then it wasn't really until I interacted with you and people who knew you that I realized, like, oh, Joseph really knows a lot about this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he knows, this is not, not that I thought you were faking it or something, but there are, like, everybody knows a little bit about Doctor Who, or, like, you know a lot about it.
Yeah, I'm a very obsessive person, and I was a big Star Wars and a big Doctor Who and specific comic books fan growing up, and those worlds used to be kind of separate from whatever was on television.
Right.
And now it's sort of like Game of Thrones is a geek thing, but it is also just plain one of the most popular television shows on the air. So you can kind of disappear into the rabbit hole of knowing the most about it, but it's not the same as it used to be.
Well, yeah, and that's actually interesting, is that the people define geek when they feel like they have to as, some people just say it's about how you like something. So there is a world of thought who would say just being obsessive about anything, whether it was like baseball or Game of Thrones, would be geeky. And then there are people who are like, well, I like Doctor Who a little. Is that a geeky thing? And
yeah, I think so.
I love the school of like, everybody, it's fine. It's really not that important to set a boundary on this word.
I absolutely agree with that. Philosophically, I totally agree with that. I think it is all about what you love, and I think that it's going to become kind of a non-argument, because the normal world, in the geek world, like in the Game of Thrones example, there's a synergy there.
Yeah.
But I do think a thing that some of us geeks don't talk about when we also talk about this sort of pride, and it is accessible and open to anybody, we want to invite people. Then I remember that, hey, if I brought a friend who really didn't know a lot about the community to a convention, there would be a lot of just weird things shouted that, you know, suddenly somebody dressed up in smelly leather and with weird things on their head would say kapla and hand them a vial of pink vodka. And they wouldn't know, oh, yes, at conventions, people dress up as Klingons and give you colored vodka.
Yeah.
This is quite normal. This is like Tuesday in the geek world.
That has never happened to me, and now I really need to go. Is that Dragon Con? Do I need to go to
Dragon Con and Convergence in Minneapolis, that kind of thing happens. But there are just like little catchphrases. Like, I think people who have probably seen Star Wars a lot and like Star Wars might not just automatically respond to anything with "Hot Shot First!" and just have all of the cultural implications of that, to know that, well, in 1997, there was a special edition in which blah, blah, blah was...
Yeah.
And I do think that there is still a sort of sub-level of geek knowledge where there are, like, social mores in their actual forms of communication. Knowing what a brown coat is different than having watched Firefly.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Absolutely. Okay, so I want to trace your geekery back to the beginning, if you don't mind.
I was born a small child.
Okay. I know the story about Doctor Who, but have you been interested in, like, robots and fantasy? Like, where did that start? What kind of kid were you when that came to you?
I was not super science-y, techie, math good, and I, in fact, would get bored when we talked about, like, space, because like my teacher would want to just tell me real things about the moon. I'm like, but aren't there aliens there? Don't the ice warriors live there? So I've always been on the creative side of geekery, but just in terms of how it began, I think it just happened to be what was around me. In that, like, one of my earliest memories is drawing a picture of Batman from like a rerun of the old 1960s Batman, in seeing Star Wars at a very young age and kind of transferring that into sort of, I mean, just sort of the force that helped me understand, like, the universe. Like, my dad taught me to play the drums when I was a teenager. Okay. And by then, like, Star Wars was so a part of me, I would think about, like, the idea of, like, well, Luke has to really be in control. He has to know exactly what he's doing, but he also needs to be calm about it. And, like, that's how I understood drumming. You know,
wow.
So I think it's I attached to these things and imprinted on them early enough that some of these stories are like, Star Wars is a movie, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad.
Right.
But the central ideas have just been a part of my waking life.
So, yeah. So it's sort of like the religion and morals of your
childhood and how to be a person
was
Star Wars. Yeah. Because your family brought that to you?
Yeah, yeah. It was just, you know, a popular movie, so we went and saw it. Yeah. And then we loved it. So, and I think a lot of the adults at that time are like, well, I don't know what the fuck this is, but I guess I'll buy them these little plastic things.
Right. But yeah, but Star Wars and, like, Batman, those are like, the comics and they're sci-fi, but they're the main stream part of that.
Yeah.
I would say. I mean, not that that makes them less important.
Yeah.
But Doctor Who, like, I'm sitting here and I see more Doctor Who DVDs than I've ever seen in my entire life.
And it's not that many at all. It's nowhere near as many as I want.
Was that a childhood thing as well?
Doctor Who was kind of early teens when it was being broadcast on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first thing where I think I learned sort of the negative side of what we've been talking about, of the sort of the shame in the ostracizing of, if I'm going to like this, and at that time, if I'm going to be out and proud about it, there's not this sort of like, it's not about what you love, it's about, it was
about what you
freakish loved. That I loved this weird thing, and the comedy bit I do about it, you know, I tried to convince my friends to watch it, and they watched it, and they literally said, that show is so stupid, if you keep watching it, it will give you AIDS. So, I mean, it's horrible and funny, and it is also a good example, I think, of the geek culture of being ostracized, of being outside the norm of, I'm going to commit to liking this thing that other people are kind of being actively, it is so foreign and so weird and so uncool that other people are going to ostracize you for liking it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, the love of Doctor Who is a different thing because I experienced that, but at the same time, the show is so much about intelligence and about trying to understand where other people are coming from and coming up with clever solutions and having conflict and violence be the last resort, that the show itself kind of taught me how to deal with people not liking me because I liked the show.
Yeah, so people picking on you or whatever about it didn't make you stop at all?
No. No. It made me retreat deeper into it. And then I think you get into the danger zone of geekdom of, like, it's great when you can run away to this world.
Yeah.
These imaginary worlds. But it's dangerous when you stay there, you know, to the deficit of the real world.
Yeah. So what was your relationship with geekdom and Doctor Who, like, from high school through the rest of your education, through, like, young adulthood? Did that remain an important part of your life?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the being geeky about comedy itself and really starting to watch Saturday Night Live and starting to analyze kind of how comedy functions and how culture is communicated through comedy, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I got geeky about comedy, but then I felt by that point, I just knew how I naturally was geeky about things. If I liked something, I was obsessive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I started performing comedy, I had to do normal comedy in, like, clubs or theaters. And then I would go to one convention, Convergence in Minnesota, and I would do Doctor Who jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was weird to be at a convention of 500 people who knew what a Dalek was.
Yeah, and so you were talking about this thing that you have known about, but you haven't been able to use in your comedy necessarily.
Yeah, and it's just a separate world. Like, it was literally like, and I had a friend at the time, this is probably like the early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
who was arguing, like, well, we should go do our Dalek sketch just at one of these theaters in Minneapolis, where I was living at the time, and no. We pretended to be Daleks by holding plumbers and screeching in weird Dalek voices. And
it was
like a comedy sketch about what the Dalek's home life was like. And it was like, I played the old grandpa Dalek, you know, screamed for the young Daleks to get off his lawn. And and he was honestly saying, like, well, you should just go do that. And it was like, no, literally, it's not like people wouldn't like that. They would just truly think it was like some weird performance art that I'm holding a plunger and screaming. It had no meaning or significance. So just that idea that I could probably go to most normal theaters and say, hey, you know those monsters on Doctor Who? And a lot of people would know exactly what that is enough to come in to the comedy and experience it, you know?
Have you ever been at any point sort of evangelical in your geekdom about, like, things like Doctor Who or Star Wars, where you feel like you have to make other people enjoy it too?
No. I am happy to defend my likes, and I like having substantive conversations with friends. Like, if somebody really just thinks that this Harry Potter movie is horrible, and I think this Harry Potter movie is great. I really like having actual discussions about the hows and the whys mm-hmm. of why we like different things. But I really don't like people struggling with the difference between objective and subjective. Mm-hmm. And I think that does happen in the geek community
yeah.
from time to time, where it's a great thing that the community can be cohesive, but yeah. I don't like it when we become cohesive that this is good and this is bad.
Yeah, you don't need to shake somebody till they like Firefly or
yes.
something.
Yes.
And so it was Doctor Who, like, the first sci-fi TV show you watched?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. there were some, like, weird bits and pieces on American television, mm-hmm. but nothing is sort of, like, expansive as Doctor Who, and I think that was one of the cool things of... He went wherever. There
yeah.
would be, like, a history episode where I would learn actual history, but then he would mm-hmm. also go and fight weird monsters in space, and I think just in terms of sort of, like, creative growth, I loved that sort of, like, anything goes...
Yeah.
Almost any idea can make its way into this show for an episode or two.
Yeah. Did you go beyond that? Are you like a Star Trek person also and all of this? And further than that, do you limit yourself to what you consider to be good sci-fi and fantasy to watch or read or absorb? Or...
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah. Star Trek. Star Trek was big. I watched almost all of the broadcast
uh-huh.
Star Trek. I have... very specific memories of watching Next Generation mm-hmm. when it first came on. And, like, I had already liked Star Trek, so I was like, come yeah. on, Star Trek, come back, you can do it.
what's the worst sci-fi show you've watched more than one episode of?
Oh, worst sci-fi show.
Or, like, worst for you, not that it's substantively, you don't have to tell people it's bad. But.
There are comedy bits about this, too, but, like, I was really excited to go see the prequels.
Mm-hmm.
And then even once they were bad, and I knew they were bad.
The Star Wars prequels, just
Star
for
Wars
anybody
prequels.
Who's...
Yes, sorry, did I just say the prequels? See?
Yeah. Yeah,
The new Star Wars movies that came out 15 years ago. no, I know that they are bad,
mm-hmm.
but there are moments of joy from watching them.
Yeah.
Because there are individual moments I like. Or like, I think the movies are horrible, but I think... Ewan McGregor is a great actor.
Yeah.
So I like watching Ewan McGregor try to make scenes good.
Yeah.
So I enjoy watching them. I know they're bad films.
Uh-huh.
But I don't care.
Are there unpopular sci-fi series that you watched?
I'm trying to I don't think it's really sci-fi because for me
yeah.
at this point it's sort of blended together. Like I like science fiction, but like I really like 24 and I don't think 24 is the best show. I think it has a lot of
yeah.
problems, but it's the one that jumps to my mind because it's the one I've been thinking about in terms of
mm-hmm.
I really like this show, but I'm a little shy about telling people I like this show.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people have sort of like legitimate quality issues or, you know, sort of political issues
yeah.
with where the show has gone. But it's one of those things of like, I like it and
yeah.
I enjoy watching it even when I know it's bad because, again, it's fun for me to just sort of think about what is good about it, what is bad about it, and to some extent, I'm a pretty analytical guy, but there's some stuff that I can't quite, without deeply psychoanalyzing myself, know exactly why I
yeah.
do or don't like certain things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I try to just like what I like.
Yeah. Do you think that you have a particular like for British shows that have the same character played by a bunch of different people?
You mean like James Bond?
Like James Bond?
Yeah.
Or Doctor Who?
Yeah. I want James Bond to regenerate. I just want him to full out regenerate
yeah.
into the next actor. We've been cheated all these years. I want to see Daniel Craig turn into Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, that's not James Bond, is it?
No, maybe. Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. No, I do. I really like British sensibilities.
Comedy also? Or
comedy in particular. I like a lot of the new science fiction. I like Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I like Sherlock, not that it's science fiction, but
yeah.
but it's genre geeky stuff.
Yeah.
No, I think that I lived in London for just a few months when my wife was getting her master's degree,
yeah.
and there's something to me about the fact that the country is just so much older than the United States
yeah.
that our sort of like collective attitude towards things is different, where America is kind of like still uptight about some things, like we're
mm-hmm.
just learning. It feels like America is a teenager who's just learning about sex and is really excited about it, but kind of awkward about it too.
Yeah.
And England is just sort of like this 50-year-old wise sort of like, what? It's no big deal. I can say a deeply philosophical thing, and then a moment later, there can be a penis joke, and it's really no big deal.
Yeah.
Calm down, America. It's not one or the other. It's not like, you know, in particular in their comedy, I love that it can be like, here's a dumb wordplay on, you know, Fanny or whatever, and in the middle of something that's also just very intelligent or sad or insightful about the human condition.
Mm-hmm. I would like to hear you have geeky opinions about current Doctor Who. Do you have those?
Oh, I have so many.
Okay.
I have so many.
Okay, so the new Doctor, and this is my... Is he on the television yet?
Peter Capaldi?
Yes.
No, he will be coming in August.
All right, and how do you feel about this casting?
Please. Sorry, the way I said, he will be coming in August. Like, I don't even have glasses and I pushed them up. No, I'm thrilled with Peter Capaldi. I think it is... my general opinion is I'm thrilled that the show came back. I'm thrilled that it was done in a way that brought in new people.
It did not ruin it for you that the Doctor became dreamy.
No.
Okay.
But it was weird. It was difficult for me.
Yeah.
Because there had always been... The Doctor was always very romantic in the widest sense of what the word romantic means.
Mm-hmm.
He had never, ever been... horny.
Yeah.
And I don't mind that he's dreamy and attractive. There had certainly been attractive actors who played the Doctor.
Yeah.
and certainly an element of lots of attractive companions, men and women. But the idea that so much of the Doctor's life, especially as David Tennant, was consumed with who might he want to snog, who might want to snog him... Who doesn't he want to snog? And it's just sort of like, you're a 1,000-year-old alien.
Yeah.
And it was just getting a little like, I thought there was going to be episodes where we're just like, the Doctor passes a note in gym class to see.
Yeah.
So
that episode did not come out.
Sadly.
Okay.
No. I think David Tennant did a great job, but the amount that the Doctor was really sort of modern and hip in his own sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big cranky Doctor Who nerd about. So I loved it when Matt Smith came back, when Matt Smith came back, he brought back that sort of idea of the Doctor being very alien.
Yeah.
So that he was certainly seemed to have romantic feelings towards characters, but I love that he literally, like, you know, there's that episode called The Lodger where he is hiding out on Earth for quite a while, and he's rooming with this guy, and he's just totally screwing up this guy's romantic life.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doctor just doesn't get that he is accidentally playing this romantic third wheel.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the Doctor, is this guy who has great romance in his heart, but doesn't understand the nitty-gritty of how to date Earth people.
Yeah. So what are your hopes for the new Doctor, who is now... He's an old guy now.
I hope that he is going to be sort of what they've teased, which is somebody who is a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more rock and roll, as opposed to emo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay, I have one last question for you.
Excellent.
Which is, I would like you to describe the perfect sci-fi TV show.
The perfect sci-fi...
Or the best you can think of.
The best that I can... Yeah, because if I can describe the perfect one...
Uh-huh.
I live in Hollywood now, so I should probably just write it real quick.
Yeah.
But the best for me
As just to view, not to, like, become popular or something. But, like, for you to watch, what would it be?
For me to watch, there is a central character who has a great sense of compassion and of romance.
Mm-hmm.
And also... sort of doubt and concern about the human and or alien condition. And they are surrounded by both friends and conflict, and things blow up sometimes.
Not every episode. Oh, okay.
Only sometimes.
I love it. I'll sign me up. I would love to watch. Thank you very much, Joseph Scrimshaw, for joining us on Nerd Portland Radio.
Thank you.
Please find Joseph Scrimshaw on Twitter and check out his album Flawfest, a full-length comedy album with its own original soundtrack.
That's right.
our final segment here on Nerd Portland Radio, we'd like to recommend to you some geekery to check out here in Portland. Of course, you should solve your way to Puzzled Pint on Tuesday evening.
Yeah, there will be a puzzle leading you to the venue, like we said, posted on puzzlepint.com this coming Monday.
And all good geeks should know that the Nerdist himself, Mr. Chris Hardwick, is coming to Portland's Helium Comedy Club next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. You're going, right, Richard?
Yeah, I really like his podcasts, so and, you know, Midnight, so I'm jazzed to see him talk about grapefruiting live on stage.
I have no idea what that is.
It's probably good.
Okay, well, he will be at Helium Comedy Club. Look that up. And that is it for us on Nerd Portland Radio this week.
Thanks for tuning in.